the blessing of meeting with you tonight as we continue our study on enduring well or finishing well, enduring to the end. James is a great practical guide to finishing well. That characteristic of endurance in which a person is not swayed, that does not swerve from their path, even through the greatest trials, through the greatest temptations, they continue on, finishing well. That's the goal of every Christian. That's the desire of every Christian. Lord, as Paul prayed in Romans 9, I keep my body under subjection, lest by any means, after I have myself taught others, I would find myself becoming a castaway. Finishing well. James is a practical guide to enduring. We're going to look at verses 5 through 8 tonight of James 1. The first section is James telling us that it is through the use of trials in our lives, trials to prove what we are as Christians, trials to purge away the dross and the impurities that we might endure better, that patients might have a perfect work. It is through trials that we endure well. That's God's ordained means of Christians enduring. It's through trials. He gives us the grace to endure. He has promised that no trial will be above that which we were able to bear. He will give us the grace to endure, and He will give us the means or the path to escape. And that's wonderful to know, isn't it? It's through trials, my brethren, count it all joy. Not to feel joy, but to regard it as joy because you know what God is doing in your life as you endure trials. He then points us to another very necessary and key ingredient to enduring well. Let's read this in James 1, verse 5. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Now this passage closes, or this section closes, with a description of one who will not endure, who will not finish well. He is the double-hearted man, the double-souled man. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. And so what is the path to stability, or what is the path to enduring well that James describes tonight? He says that a necessary ingredient, if you and I are to endure well, to finish well, a necessary component of our lives must be wisdom. Wisdom. Isn't that interesting? He starts off with trials, and the very next key component that he gives us is that of wisdom. Now just hearing that word, if you are a very aware Christian at all, just hearing that word draws, at least in my heart, a sense of longing. Does it not? Does it not just make a great desire well up within you as you maybe just very quickly in your mind just kind of run to all of the aspects of your life? Perhaps you are a father or a mother and you very quickly recognize your great need of wisdom in raising your children. Whatever role you have in life, you recognize, Lord, that's it. I need great wisdom. Wisdom. What is wisdom? What is wisdom? Let's turn to Proverbs 8, because Proverbs 8 gives us both a great description of wisdom, and it also gives us the beauty or the desire that we should have to be clothed with wisdom. Wisdom is one of those words that is difficult to define, isn't it? There are plenty of pithy definitions of wisdom that always just seem to be kind of lacking in my mind, that don't seem to grab me that much. It is more than knowledge, is it not? It's more than knowledge. It's one thing to know what is right. It's another thing to do what is right. It's certainly discretion is included in the fault, but it's more than just discretion. Wisdom is almost that undefinable grace that takes you from knowing what is right to doing what is right. It takes you from not from understanding to putting into practice. And truly, you cannot use the word wisdom without understanding that it is a grace. Notice that it says in this passage that those who ask of God for wisdom, every man who asks God for wisdom will receive it. Well, why is it that we don't have more wise people in our world today? Because people don't go to God to seek wisdom. And so it's a grace of God. Those who seek wisdom from God have been touched by the grace of God, have had their eyes opened to see that God is the source of all wisdom, and that wisdom is a needy, is a thing that I must have. I can't navigate life without wisdom, right? If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, it says. So wisdom certainly is a grace. 1 Corinthians 2 describes a worldly wisdom. And it says in that passage, if you remember that passage, it talks about how that all the smart people, the smartest, wisest men of that day, all gathered together in a convention to put their wise, smart, crafty minds together to decide how they could do away with this annoying person who was infiltrating their peace and their comfort. It was causing all sorts of problems, and they put their minds together to see how they could do away with Christ. And God says in 1 Corinthians 2, that was worldly wisdom. And it says, if they had truly understood who He was, they would never have done what they did. So the wisdom we're describing tonight is something that the world knows not of. The wisdom we describe comes from heaven, from the Father of lights, the Father of light, in whom is no variable, in the shadow of turning. This is a light that God gives, a light for the Christian to navigate this dark and uncertain and troubling, unsettling world and confusing. And so in the midst of trouble and confusion and darkness and unsettling things and confusing things, there is a bright light that shines. And that light is wisdom that God gives. So how we need wisdom, right? How we desperately need wisdom. This week, as I was contemplating this passage, it was almost as if I just got stuck at the very first part of this. As I was preparing to present to you what the passage says, I just got stuck on the phrase, "If any of you lack wisdom." And I thought, Lord, that's where I am. I need wisdom. I thought of all the different places in my pastorate, in my life, I need wisdom. I said, Lord, This is great. I need this, God. Give me wisdom. So we'll see what God says about that in a minute. So in Proverbs 8, we have a good description of wisdom and also a good description of the beauty of wisdom and the need of wisdom. And it's interesting in Proverbs 8 that it starts off like this: "Doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice?" Now, the reason that it's interesting that it starts off this way is that in Proverbs 5, and then again in Proverbs 7, we have another voice crying. And it is the voice of the temptress who is crying after, if you remember the simple one in Proverbs 7, the one who is void of understanding and who is inviting him with her loud voice, inviting him to come into her house and to taste of her delicacies and to enjoy the fruits of pleasure. And so as you know, the simple one in Proverbs 7 and in Proverbs 5, the simple one walks into her house unsuspecting, unaware, and it says, "And he goeth forth as an ox goeth to the slaughter, and is a fool to the correction of the stocks, and he knoweth not that it is for his life." And so the comparison from Proverbs 5 and 7 is of this loud voice crying for us, right? Well, praise the Lord, friends. If you know Jesus Christ, if you are a child of God, bought by the blood of Christ, a redeemed, a recipient of redemption, there is another voice crying loudly to you tonight. Isn't that wonderful? Proverbs 5 and 7, we're very familiar with the voice of temptation, are we not? It may not be the temptation described in Proverbs 7. It may be something completely different, but we're very, very familiar with a loud cry of temptation that seems to just rack our ears, right? Well, guess what? There's another loud cry, and it's crying just as loudly, and it is that which will lead to life and not destruction. So doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice. She standeth in the top of high places, by the way in the places of the paths. She crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in, at the doors. Unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of man. O ye simple, understand wisdom, and you fools, be ye of an understanding heart. Let's just stop right there for a minute, because I want to again bring to your mind Proverbs 7. We read that Sunday, did we not? Proverbs 7. She says, who was it that heard her voice and turned to the temptress? It was the simple one, the one who was void of understanding. And so he went into her house because he was simple. He was not aware. He was not aware of the dangers that lurked within. Here in Proverbs 8, it says, O ye simple, and it says, and ye fools. So what I want to point out to us tonight is a joyous declaration, and that is being simple and being a fool is not a death knell. It's not a death blow to not have understanding. You understand? The mistake of the man was not that he was simple. The mistake was that he listened to the wrong voice. And so the joyous thing is that even if we are lacking tonight, are you lacking in wisdom? Are you lacking in understanding? Can you think of a specific place? You probably can. Right now in your life where you know that you need wisdom and you know you don't have the wisdom. Brother David's prayer answer tonight was one of those situations. I've got a problem. I know that I'm just going to pick on you tonight. I know that I am prone to anger, he said last Wednesday night, right? I'm prone to anger. I know that God's working on me about this, and I know I have a difficult situation. It's very sticky, and I want you to pray for me that I'll handle it the right way, and it'll be settled, and that I won't be provoked to anger, right? That's basically the prayer, okay? So he confesses, I'm a simple one. I am void of understanding, unsure how to proceed in this case in a God-honoring way. Well, guess what? Wisdom says, listen to me. Oh, ye simple, understand wisdom, and you fools, be of an understanding heart. God provides where we lack. That's the great thing. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. Here's wisdom. For my mouth shall speak truth. Wisdom always tells the truth. Wisdom always leads to truth. And wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Wisdom turns us away from wickedness. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing froward or perverse in them. Did you hear that? Wisdom always leads us away from that which is froward and that which is perverse. It always leads to righteousness. They are all plain to him that understandeth, and right to them that find knowledge. Receive my instruction. Here's the value of wisdom. Receive my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. In other words, wisdom leads to discretion, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. And the next phrase, you're probably familiar with it, says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Now, why is that interjected into this passage? Because in Proverbs 9, verse 10, and other places, it says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. True wisdom. The wisdom that we are greatly in need of in order that we might endure well. True God-given wisdom. The very beginning place, the very starting place, it says in Proverbs 9, verse 10, is it starts at the fear of God. The fear of God. The fear of the Lord is a beginning place. It is a starting place. You cannot have wisdom. Hear this? You cannot have wisdom if you don't also have a fear of God. Now, John Gill gives a good definition in my mind of what the fear of God is. I'll read it to you. The fear of God is an awe, and a reverence joined with love to Him. I'll stop right there. This is not a good comparison, but I'll give it to you anyway. There was something about my grandfather, Tony Machiavello, who many of you knew, that just caused us as children to have just almost an awe of him. We had a reverence of him. He never spanked me that I can remember. He never really spoke above a very soft voice. But I know that I obeyed him much better than I obeyed my parents. I remember that they didn't have very much money. I remember they had saved their money and they had bought a new rug that went into their living room. And so from that point on in their living room, we could never take our drinks, our cups, and our food in there anymore. They told us this is the rule. You cannot take your cups, you can't take your food into the living room. And you know what? We always remembered that. We always remembered that. It wasn't because there was ever any bad incident where somebody messed up and spilled the rug. That never happened. But all these children, many, many children, all of them always remembered to not take drinks or food into his living room. And I think the reason was because we had a real reverence for him. We wanted to please him. We loved him. So it's an awe. It's an awe of God. You see God as being a great God, a God who is not an ogre, but a God who is an object of great desire. And you're in awe of the majesty of God. Are you tonight in awe of the majesty, the rightness, of the purity of our great God? Are you in awe of one who is just and right in all his ways? Are you in awe of one in whom is light and in him is no darkness at all? Are you in awe of the compassion and the mercy of God? Are you in awe of a God who is holy but can be long-suffering to this point in history? Can you imagine the long-suffering of God? Does that cause awe to well up in your heart toward God? Not just toward your case, but to all this, to all of our world that we're still here, that He's still sustaining us and breathing the breath of life into us and still providing for us bountifully after we as individuals and as a world at large have turned our backs on Him, yet His long-suffering continues and we still have sustenance and we still have provisions and we still have grace. When you see God, when you think of God, there's an awe and a reverence of God well up within you. So it's an awe and a reverence of God that is coupled or joined with love to Him. It's joined with love to Him. It's joined with trust in Him. And it's joined with a desire to serve and worship Him in a right manner. If you don't have a desire to serve and to worship God in a right way, you won't have wisdom. Because God will provide wisdom to those who are walking in darkness. But God will provide great wisdom to those who have an awe and a love for Him and want to be like Him and want to be close to Him and want to please Him, and they serve Him because they please Him. And so there is also certainly a certain fear that goes along with that. But it's not a fear or a fear of someone who is, again, an ogre, or a fear of one who is a criminal. It's not like that at all, is it? That's not the way we fear God. But it is a fear, let me put it this way, it's a fear of offending. A fear of offending God that comes as a result of love, right? Let me say that again. It's a fear of offending God that results or arises from love to Him. I'm not trying to, I think she's not even here, I'm not trying to butter her up, but that's exactly how I view my wife's love to me. Her love for me is so much more pure in my mind than my love for her. When I get irritated, I don't usually mind saying what I'm irritated about. And I don't always do it in the right way. And I know that it probably have consequences. I'll have to go, do right and make the offense right later. But I'm telling you, Rachel has, she hates to do anything that would offend me. I'm not telling you that I just love to offend. I don't mean that. But I'm much more careless than she is as regards offending the other spouse. She hates to offend me. And it's not because I've ever been cruel to her. It's not because we have a tested relationship. It's not because I turn into a mean tyrant. She hates to offend me because she hates to ever hurt me because she loves me so much. That's what we're talking about. When you fear God, you love Him so much, you just do not want to offend Him. And friends, that's the very starting place of wisdom. That's where wisdom arises from. It's where our ability to not only know right, but to do right comes from an awe, a reverence, a love of God. I want to please Him because I love Him so much. I want to please Him so He'll give me a reward. I want to please Him because I love Him. It's enough. His love is enough, right? So the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Wisdom leads us to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. Counsel or advice is mine. Don't we need good counsel? We need wise advice. It's the founded wisdom. And sound or strong wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. We can read the rest of that chapter and glean a lot of wonderful things about wisdom. I just want to point that out. So wisdom is to hate evil. It is to turn towards righteousness. It is to have wise and good counsel and advice. It is to speak truth. It's to hate wickedness. That's what wisdom is. It's knowing and doing and desiring godly things. Now let me ask you, do we need wisdom? Do we need light? Do we need wisdom? And we'll say yes, right? So what does it say to us? Isn't wisdom necessary to finishing well, to enduring well? So He says to us, if any of you lack wisdom, let's stop right there for a moment. Because sometimes, as Christians, we learn the basic do's and don'ts, if you will, of the Word. We learn how to be a, quote, good Christian. So we think that our common sense is enough to get us through life. And we may not even be aware of it, but we kind of stop listening. We stop listening. We stop heeding the need to change. And to, Brother David said last week, to address things in our lives that we have been there for a long time. We think we know the Word and we know life. And so that, the common sense, and we're pretty good to go and live the rest of our lives. And so, friends, the very starting place in this passage, this promise to us of enduring well is if we admit, if we acknowledge that we are lacking in wisdom. So we're not at the place where we are ready to admit we are lacking wisdom. The rest of this passage is not really for us. If any of you lack wisdom, He's not saying it's possible that some of you don't lack wisdom. He's not saying that. It's more rhetorical. The truth of the matter is, He could have said it this way, since we all are greatly lacking in wisdom. Let's listen to this next passage. And that's the truth. I remind you of Isaiah 57:15 and Isaiah 66 verse 1. They both say this in similar ways. Isaiah 57:15 says, "Thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in a high and holy place." That's God, right? His name is holy. He dwells in a high and holy place. And He says, "And I also dwell with him as of a contrite and humble spirit." And the other passage says, "And trembleth at my word." So humility. Humility. If we're to endure well, we must have the humility to say, "Lord, I'm lacking. I'm greatly lacking in wisdom. And I need wisdom." Somebody wrote this. I thought it was good. I don't know who it was that wrote it. It said, "A sense of spiritual poverty is a great blessing when it leads the humble soul to God." Did you hear that? A sense of spiritual poverty is a great blessing when it leads the humble soul to God. Really, the first step of gaining wisdom is recognizing your lack of wisdom and acknowledging your great need of wisdom. I need to fear you better, God. I need to love you better. I need to have more prudence and discretion. I need to give better counsel. Oh, how heavy upon my heart this is. I need to give good advice. I need to have discretion, understanding, and knowing. Lord, I need wisdom. If any of you lack wisdom, what does it say? Let him ask of God. Let him ask of God. Let him go to God, who giveth to all men liberally. Turn to James 1 again. Let's read this passage again. James 1. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. Now, we're not going to finish this passage tonight. I can see that right now. So let me just spend about 10 more minutes, if you will give me 10 more minutes. And let's just contemplate God for a minute, okay? Because what does it say about this one to whom we are being told to go to find this great need of our souls, of our lives? If any of you lack wisdom, he says, just go to God. He's talking about going to God in prayer. And he's talking about going to God in His Word. That's where the wisdom is found. But let him ask of God. And then it describes some things about God that should be absolutely cheering to the humble heart that recognizes their great need of wisdom. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And it says next, who giveth to all men liberally. And it says, and upbraideth not. So he tells us some things about God, first of all. Who is this one in whom we are going to? Why do we go to him? Well, first of all, because he has no lacking of wisdom himself. Whereas we lack for wisdom, he has no lack. John 1 says that he has grace for grace. He has grace in infinite supply, never to run out. But he also has all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge in himself, as Colossians 2, Jesus Christ, in him are all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So we go to God because he has it all. He has all the wisdom. Okay? But secondly, it says, he gives to all men. Now, who are these all men? It is all the men, all the people who will go to him and ask for it. Why is it that others don't receive it? Because they won't go and ask. So God gives this wisdom to all men who ask for it. That's good news, too. Do you know what it says? It says that as opposed to us, in James 2, there is no partiality with God. There is no respect of persons with God. He gives to all men. All men who come to Him seeking wisdom, He says, I will give you wisdom. Now that is a great healer to one of the great barriers that we have oftentimes in our lives. That barrier is this. We see someone like the Apostle Paul. We see the great grace and the great wisdom that he was blessed with to encounter such obstacles and to continue to live his life for the glory of God. We cannot really imagine saying, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain, and I don't really care what happens to me today. All I care about is that Christ be magnified in my body, whether by life or death. We can't imagine saying that on a regular basis, can we? Not really honestly, can we? Hopefully we can. Hopefully we can. That seems like such a high level of Christianity, doesn't it? Like such a superior level of wisdom, does it not? What does it say? It says there is no partiality with God. God doesn't give Paul a wisdom that he will not give you. You hear that? He won't. He won't give Paul a grace that he will not also give to you. There's no respect of persons with God. There's no partiality with God. He will give to all men. I hear this in my office in counseling a lot of times. I'll say this, Brother Isaac, when you say it, it makes so much sense, but you're strong and you're a preacher. And you know what? That's not true. And well, I'm not strong because I'm a preacher. I'm only as strong as the grace that God gives me. And He will give you the same grace that He will give me. Because there's no partiality with God. Oh, what a fix to a barrier that we place that's not a godly barrier. He gives it to all men. Then it says, He giveth to all men liberally. Liberally. I want to turn to just a few passages real quickly that talks about what God does for those who fear Him. I'll just turn these quickly. You may not have time to look them all up. Psalm 85, verse 9. Surely His salvation is nigh them that fear Him. Glory may dwell in our land. I read it again. Surely His salvation is nigh them that fear Him. Does that sound like a liberal giver to you? There may be a new headline in the Sun Sentinel tomorrow. God is a liberal. That'd be kind of strange, wouldn't it? That's what it says. He's a liberal giver. He giveth liberally. If He will give His salvation, how much of His salvation is deserved? How much of it is earned? How much of it is due you? What does God owe you? Can you answer that? What does God owe you? It says He will give even His salvation. Do you understand what salvation is? Salvation is more than just being absolved of our sins. Salvation means that we have the righteousness of Jesus Christ. The very next verse says, mercy and truth are met together, and righteousness and peace have kissed each other. He gives peace with God on the basis of the blood of Christ, His only begotten Son. See, God's a liberal giver. He gives abundantly, does He not? Psalm 103, verse 13 says, as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth those that fear Him. And Psalm 115, verse 11 says it this way. Ye that fear the Lord, trust in the Lord. Why? Because He is their help and their shield. There are no qualifiers for that. God is our help. He's a very present help in time of trouble, right? A refuge and strength, a very present help. He Himself will come and bear you up on His shoulders. The everlasting God underneath are His arms, right? The eternal God is our refuge and underneath the everlasting arms. See, God is liberal. He gives even of Himself to us. So friends, just view for a minute. God has invited us to come to seek Him for wisdom and look at Him. He has no partiality. He's a source of all wisdom. And He loves to give it liberally. Was that not the case of Adam and Eve in the garden? He gave them everything except for that one tree. So we get God kind of confused. Satan would like to confuse our minds regarding God and tell us that God is a stingy giver and a reluctant giver. And God is neither. He gave them the whole garden. He gave them dominion over all the animals of the earth, over all the land. He withheld one tree from them. And on through history, we see the same thing, friends. God has given us liberty in Christ, freedom from the bondage of sin. He's a liberal giver. He gives abundantly. Isn't that good to know a God who gives abundantly? But I'm going to share with you one more word. This word liberal actually is taken from the root word, a root word in which other places in the Bible is translated simplicity. For God gives with simplicity. Now that sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? I'm thinking of God giving abundantly, and we hear God giving simplicity, and that doesn't sound quite as good, does it? Listen to what this means. When it says God gives liberally or with simplicity, it means He gives without adding aught. That means anything. Without adding anything that might take away from the graciousness of the gift. I give my, sending Luke to a basketball camp next week. And before we agreed to do it, I said, Luke, I'm sending you to this camp. But you need to understand something. This is costing Daddy a lot of money. And so if you don't put in the time and the effort in these next few weeks and practicing your basketball and doing your running and working hard, you see, what was that? That was not giving with simplicity, was it? There wasn't anything wrong with what I said, I don't think. But what it was, God doesn't do it that way. God gives without adding anything that would take away from the graciousness of the gift. I'm giving you this because I love you. I had no layers to it. I give with simplicity. That's a liberal gift, is it not? That's a wonderful gift. And it says this, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Let me read you some of the words that this same word upbraid is used in different ways in the New Testament. Matthew 5:11, where it says, blessed are ye when men revile you. The same word is upbraid. In Matthew 27, verse 44, speaking of the ones who were mocking and hating Christ just before as he was being led to Calvary, it says, they cast the same in his teeth. It's the same word upbraid. In Mark 15, it says, they that were crucified with him, the two thieves, they were crucified with him, they reviled him. Remember the hatred they had, even going to their death, until one was miraculously changed by the Spirit of God. 1 Peter 4 says, at that time, blessed are ye if you are reproached. If you are reproached in the name of Christ. All those words are the same word, reviled and reproached and casting the same in his teeth. And it says this, God won't do that. He won't do that because you haven't come before or because you failed miserably. He won't do that because you'll probably take advantage of his goodness and grace in the future and forget to go to him again for wisdom. He won't do that. He won't revile you. He won't reproach you. He won't cast the same into your teeth for your failures. God won't do that. And so we'll finish this passage next time. I just want you to keep that thought in mind of the God who has told us, invited us to come to Him for this incredible need that we have. What a God. May God bless you.